From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty reporting. President Donald Trump is set to announce a new set of tariffs Thursday. These targeting Chinese imports that could total $60 billion. The White House said the action followed an investigation into what is called China's state-led market-distorting efforts to force, pressure, and steal U.S. technology and intellectual property. Robert Lighthizer is the U.S. Trade Representative.
We are losing that to China in ways that are not reflective of the underlying economics. So it's an enormously important issue. We think it's perhaps the most important thing that will have been done in a long time in terms of rebalancing trade and trade specifically with China.
China has threatened to retaliate. Scott Kennedy of the Centers for Strategic and International Studies said the world's two biggest economies could be embarking on a trade war that could hurt, among other things, American farmers.
I think the Chinese have talked most openly about soybeans. The U.S. is one of the largest providers of soybeans to China.
The U.S. duties are expected to single out Chinese technology and telecommunications sectors. Mr. Trump has embarked on a get-tough trade policy to help reduce its global trade deficit. Jihadist militants with the Boko Haram Sunni insurgency in Nigeria freed scores of kidnapped schoolgirls Wednesday after abducting them a month ago from a school in Dapchi in northeast Yobe State. Lai Mohammed is the Nigerian government information minister.
We have been in negotiation with these faction of insurgents for quite a while.
He said the talks involved a cessation of hostilities, including no further abductions. The captors have given no reason for the mass release, which sparked celebrations. The government denied any payment of ransom. This is VOA News. Peru's center-right president, Pedro Pablo Kuczynski, facing an impeachment vote in Congress, offered his resignation Wednesday.
El 28 de julio de 2016,
the 79-year-old former Wall Street banker said it's best for the country that he stepped down. He has denied allegations of wrongdoing. The opposition failed to impeach him in December on charges his consulting firm received money from Odebrecht, a Brazilian company, at the center of one of Latin America's biggest graft scandals. Recent videos released by his political opponents also purportedly showed his allies offering lucrative contracts to lawmakers in exchange for political support. Mark Jones is a Latin America analyst with Rice University.
President Kuczynski, from the very start, was weakened by the fact that his party controlled only a small number of seats in the legislature.
Vice President Martin Vizcarra is expected to be sworn in as his replacement on Friday. Lawmakers in Kosovo Wednesday ratified a contentious 2015 border agreement with Montenegro, another key step toward gaining visa-free travel in the European Union. Among those opposed, Albin Kurti, leader of the opposition Self-Determination Party.
The treason of President Vučić, his violation of our constitution and our laws, was joined by 80 MPs and especially by Prime Minister Haradinaj.
Opponents regard the ratification as a sellout, giving up some 8,000 hectares of land to Montenegro. They released tear gas in the parliamentary chamber. Police arrested a number of lawmakers. In Afghanistan, a suicide bomber blew himself up near a Shia shrine in Kabul Wednesday, killing at least 32 and wounding dozens more. The blast coincided with the start of the Persian New Year. Islamic State claimed responsibility. Two government ministers in Yemen resigned their posts Wednesday in protest over what they said was Saudi Arabia's decision to keep President Abu Mansour Hadi from returning to his country. Mr. Hadi is currently in exile in Saudi Arabia, which anchors a coalition fighting Houthi rebels. The U.S. Wednesday imposed sanctions on 15 South Sudanese oil operators it said were sources of cash for the government. The action is seen as aimed at pressuring Juba to end the country's long-simmering ethnic conflict, which has spawned a humanitarian crisis. Zimbabwe's new president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, Wednesday pardoned thousands of prisoners in his first act of clemency. Among those released, nearly all female prisoners. Two American astronauts and a Russian cosmonaut blasted off in a Soyuz rocket on a two-day journey to the International Space Station.
Drew Foysel, Oleg Artemyev, and Ricky Arnold taking off on their way to the International Space Station.
They will join three residents of the station, a Russian, an American, and Japanese, for a five-month stay. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Thank you. Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbatha in Washington. Today is Thursday, March 22nd. And here are some of the stories we are covering. In Sierra Leone, the party that came third in the first round vote has decided not to endorse any of the two candidates in the runoff.
Endorsing either of the two parties now, in our view, will not be showing national leadership. People will say they both are evil, but there is the lesser of the two evils. We do not believe that.
Julia Spencer is the campaign spokesman for the National Grand Coalition Party. Meanwhile, the Elections Commission has denied it used the blockchain technology in the first round vote. We'll have analysis of Africa's new free trade zone initiative and the prospect for peace and reconciliation in Mali remain hostage to extremists.
They try to impose their own interpretation of Islam, which is very restrictive. They terrorize the population and punish those who are suspected of acting as informants.
Suleiman Balde is an independent expert speaking through an interpreter. The Nigerian government said there was no ransom in the freedom of most of the 110 schoolgirls kidnapped last month by Boko Haram. And the United Nations says some 4 million refugee children are unable to attend school. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. In Sierra Leone, the party that came third in the country's March 7th first-round presidential vote has decided not to endorse any of the two candidates in next week's runoff election. Instead, the National Grand Coalition Party, led by its standard bearer, Kande Yamkela, has urged its followers to support candidates of their own choosing, but to do so by putting Sierra Leone first. The two candidates in the March 27th runoff election are retired Brigadier Julius Mada Bio of the opposition Sierra Leone People's Party and Samura Kamara of the ruling All People's Congress Party. Julius Spencer is campaign spokesman for the National Grand Coalition. He says the NGC wants to remain a vibrant opposition that will hold whichever government is elected to account.
The party is saying that it is not going to endorse or enter into a coalition with either of the two parties that are billed to contest in the runoff. But we are advising our members and supporters to make an individual decision as to who they are going to vote for if they decide to vote.
So how did the coalition reach this decision? Did you talk to your supporters about this?
Definitely, we had a series of consultations across the country with our members and supporters, and virtually almost unanimously, the view was that we should not endorse either of the two parties. They are all concerned that the NGC should not only survive but should become a strong party, beginning with being a viable opposition in parliament and ensuring that it continues to advocate for real change and speak on behalf of the ordinary people in Sierra Leone. So we have simply followed the advice and the positions that our members and supporters have taken.
Dr. Spencer, I'm assuming that your standard bearer, Mr. Yamkela, entered the race to bring about change, hoping that probably he will be elected president. Now, by you not endorsing anybody, what are you telling the people of Sierra Leone? Are you okay with the two candidates that are left for the runoff?
No, throughout the campaign, we basically argue that neither of them can lead this country to the change that we envisage, that both parties have been in governance at various times since the country gained independence, apart from a period of about 3 years or so when we had a military interregnum. It has either been the APC or the SLPP in governance, and the country has not made enough progress. So for us to now endorse either of them would be saying that we didn't really believe what we were advocating for. And we are talking about real change. We believe that we can provide an effective opposition that will hold whichever government is in place to account. We do not want to get involved directly with the government to such an extent that our positions will be compromised and will not be in a position to make the case that we feel needs to be made for ordinary Sierra Leoneans.
There are those who might say that Yom Kippur did not show national leadership, that this is the time to step forward and show leadership.
Well, he did show leadership by stepping forward to take part in the competition and endorsing either of the two parties. Now, in our view, will not be showing national leadership. People will say they both are evil, but there is the lesser of the two evils. We do not believe that. We believe that we will serve the country better, and he will serve Sierra Leone better. He will provide better leadership now by being effective in parliament rather than endorsing one of the parties and getting cozy with them while they are in governance. We believe that he needs to maintain his independence and to stand up for the ordinary man.
Dr. Spencer, thank you very much again. So nice to talk with you.
You're welcome.
Julius Spencer is campaign spokesman for the National Grand Coalition Party of Sierra Leone. He was speaking with me from the capital of Freetown. Ballot papers for Sierra Leone's March 27th presidential runoff elections are due to arrive in the country today, Thursday, from South Africa. National Electoral Commission Chief Mohammed M. N. Conte said his commission is ready to administer a free, fair and transparent runoff election. The commission has been sued for irregularities associated with the first round vote. Meanwhile, Chief Conte has denied his commission used the blockchain technology in the first round vote. The technology anonymously stores votes in an immutable ledger, thereby offering instant access to the election results.
We are not using anything that has to do with blockchain. Nothing, absolutely.
Have you been asked by this technology company to use their technology?
No, no, no. You are using a completely different database. Are not blockchain.
Did you use any database for the first round, and how is that going to be different from the runoff election?
No, we are using the same database. We are not using any different database. The same IT infrastructure is what we are using. We are having the runoff on the 27th. The same IT infrastructure. No change.
There were some people who expressed concern, both SLPP and APC. They say they are requesting for an audit of NEC. As you know, somebody has filed a petition with the Supreme Court, Mr. Koroma. What is your response to that?
Yes, some parties are asking for an audit. Honestly, I don't know what that means. But we have a system. We have a system that is dedicated. That's okay for us. This is a system we used in 2012. We just built on it. We surely are not going to allow any other audit at this time. But the process is on. We still have some results to announce.
Mr. Chairman, people were concerned when the results were announced. I think there were about how many, 10, 14 candidates that took part in the election. But we only got results for, say, three of the parties, the APC, the SLPP, and the coalition of Mr. Yom Kippur. People want to know what happened to the other candidates.
Well, 16 political parties contested. Of course, there are 17 registered political parties, but 16 of them contested for the presidential election. So, they all got votes, but most of the votes are concentrated, were shared between the APC, SLPP, the Coalition for Change, and the NGC, National Grand Coalition. The others got small, small percentages. But by our law, if no party gets 55% of the valuable votes cast, we have a rerun. So that's why we're having a rerun between the topmost candidates, that's the APC and the SLPP. And the runoff is on the 27th.
Mr. Chairman, before I let you go, let me ask this question. I was told by somebody in the SLPP saying that they were concerned about President Ernest Bai Koroma trying to put pressure on your commission. So I wanted to know whether this is happening.
No, that's really not happening. We are independent. The National Electoral Commission is independent as per the Constitution. I mean, we are not under any extraordinary pressure, really, except pressure for the work, really. But we are not getting offers from anybody, either the president or any political party, as per law.
Mr. Chairman, how prepared are you for the runoff?
Well, we are prepared. In fact, we are expecting the ballot papers tomorrow through Lunge. The ballot papers are printed in South Africa. They've been printed. We are expecting them tomorrow. We've informed the political parties. We have other materials. We are training our staff now. Right, currently, we are having the training of all the staff. So we are ready. We are actually ready.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. I wish you all the luck for the runoff election.
All right. Thank you very much.
Muhammad M. N. Context, Chief of Sierra Leone's Electoral Commission. He was speaking with me from the capital of Freetown. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, March 22nd. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. A UN expert says Mali's efforts to implement the Bamako Peace and Reconciliation Agreement remain under threat from extremist groups who are destabilizing the country. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva, where the independent expert has presented his report on the situation in Mali to the UN Human Rights Council.
The independent expert, Suleiman Baldo, recently visited Mali and says progress is being made in implementing the peace and reconciliation agreement. But he says the deteriorating security situation in the country is setting back prospects for peace. He says his visit to Mopti and the central region was disquieting. He says the security situation there is very precarious. Baldo says he was informed people in various parts of the region are living in fear and are constantly exposed to the risk of targeted assassinations and armed attacks by extremist radical groups. He speaks through an interpreter.
They try to impose their own interpretation of Islam, which is very restrictive. They terrorize the population and punish those who are suspected of acting as informants for the Malian authorities or international forces.
Baldo says international forces, including the UN MINUSMA, are the targets of asymmetric attacks on a daily basis, including the use of improvised explosive devices on roads. The independent expert says Malian security forces reportedly also commit human rights abuses during counter-terrorism operations.
These violations are serious. They include enforced disappearance and summary execution, as well as acts of torture and ill treatment. The impact of this insecurity on the local population is really quite dreadful.
Mali's Minister of Human Rights, Kadidia Sangare Koulibaly, agrees her country is facing increased violent extremism and terrorist attacks, and these are leading to grave abuses of human rights. But she says her government is making significant progress in protecting human rights, despite the many security challenges. She says Mali is taking measures to achieve justice and reconciliation and to fight impunity. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Nigerian government said there was no ransom in the freedom of most of the 110 schoolgirls kidnapped last month by Boko Haram. Instead, Information Minister Lai Mohammed says diplomacy played a large role in the girls' unconditional freedom. He says during negotiations, the insurgents were reminded that they breached ceasefire talks in which they promised not to abduct or kidnap.
If you remember, when the girls were kidnapped, Mr. President apologized to the nation and promised that he was going to ensure a quick release of these girls. Violence or confrontation will be ruled out, it will be largely diplomacy. Based on that, the federal government, with the aid of some of its friends, both locally and abroad, commenced intense negotiations with the kidnappers. And he finally agreed that the girls will be released unconditionally. Why they agreed to release the girls unconditionally is because during the negotiation for the release of the kidnapped University of Maiduguri lecturers and some oil workers, it was agreed between the parties that abductions and kidnapping should no longer be most of negotiation, and that the two parties would eventually find a way to end these hostilities, but that henceforth there should be no abduction. So the negotiators confronted the Boko Haram insurgents with this moral issue that you've breached our agreement. And that is when they promised they were going to release the girls unconditionally, which they did.
From your government point of view, do you believe diplomacy is the way to deal with Boko Haram or the military solution?
I think think when you go into an agreement with a group of insurgents and they do not breach that agreement, I think it's only honorable to continue to go by the terms of the agreement. And that was how it was possible for us first to confront them that they were not to be trusted. So where necessary, we would use diplomacy. And I think especially when the lives of innocent people are involved, diplomacy may be a better option.
I asked the question because the president in February was saying that the military was going to make sure that these girls will be returned to their relatives. So that's why I asked whether diplomacy is better than the military solution.
No, I think the president also subsequently, I think, told the nation that we would use every means, especially diplomacy, negotiation, and that because lives of these girls, that, you know, negotiation would be explored. And we started immediately to negotiate with them.
The condition under which these girls were kidnapped or taken raised concern about the security. Is your government going to look into this?
My government is already looking into this. One of the things the government has done is to deploy armed civil security corps to all schools, especially in the Northeast, and where possible also to merge far-flung, schools, in far outreaches with one another so that we don't overstretch the capacity of the forces.
Did any of the girls die during their captivity?
All I know right now is that we have 105 girls released, and from the figures we have, because the school said 110 were missing, the parents said there were 105, the Boko Haram insurgents said they actually kidnapped 107, so we are trying to resolve that issue. But as of today, they've handed over to us 105 girls and one boy.
Lau Mohammed is Nigeria's information minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Abuja. This week, Rwanda hosted the 10th extraordinary summit of the African Union. Its crowning achievement was an agreement to create a Continental Free Trade Area, or CFTA. The deal is expected to double the share of inter-African trade by 2022. 44 countries have already signed the agreement. William A. Awinando Kanyarige is Ghana's ambassador to Ethiopia. He spoke with reporter Eugene Uwimana for further explanations.
Basically, what is going to happen is that with this larger African space, if you want to add value to your products, you look at your neighbors and the market size that it affords you. So it kind of enhances the profit margins based on the large market size. That is, if we are able to go beyond the narrow domestic market. So definitely, if you look at the population of Africa alone, that is huge. What we need now is that our private sector and civil society, in particular media, need to also get more involved.
How will this deal help with employment?
Basically, what is going to happen is that when you create opportunities for business like this, in other words, you are creating jobs as well.
And what happens after the signing on March 21st? What next?
Yeah, so what is going to happen is that there are a number of key things to do. There are certain outstanding aspects of the annex protocols which still need to be negotiated. They are not complete. So that will continue. That is one. Two, those countries that have not yet signed, there will be effort for them to also come on board because some of them are not ready. That's why you haven't seen them sign. It's not because they don't want to sign. And then thirdly, very critical, the issue of sensitization. Our private sector and civil society have not yet been involved as they should. Many of them don't even know that there is something like this going on. This is where the media has a critical role to play. The last then will be ratification. Again, the sensitization should also speak to the issue of ratification so that the necessary domestic processes can be fast-tracked. For us to, as you know, the leaders have agreed that when 22 countries ratify, then automatically it enters into force.
And how will FSFTA impact trade and other sectors inside and outside Africa, development in general?
Basically, because of the opportunities it's going to unlock, which includes innovation, value addition, and all that. It also will sharpen our competitiveness with the outside world. And that goes without saying. And I can imagine that by now the outside world is watching Africa closely, because Africa will readjust, and they also have to readjust in this globalized system of exchanges. So these are going to be very exciting times, not just for Africa, but for the entire world.
Do you see any potential challenges to the implementation of these agreements?
Naturally, there will be challenges moving forward. So definitely there will be challenges in terms of readjustment, because this is about change. You are going to have to change, first of all, mindset is critical, and changing of mindset is not an easy one. Education, we need to invest in our people to be able to develop the necessary skills to take advantage of these huge opportunities, and that will require also further investment.
Does this duplicate or enhance the role of regional blocs like COMESA or East African Community or ECOWAS?
Absolutely not. The regional blocs are building blocks of this process. So what is going to happen is that the regional blocs will now naturally blend with this integrated continental arrangement. So it doesn't at all. We don't expect the regional blocks to be ending themselves. They are meant to be building blocks.
William Awinando Kanyarige is Ghana's ambassador to Ethiopia. He was speaking with reporter Eugene Uwimana from Kigali, Rwanda. Some 3.5 million refugee children are unable to attend school, according to the United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR. A majority of these are displaced children, mostly in Africa, suffering loss and dislocation as a result of war and civil conflicts in their home countries. But a three-day regional meeting in Nairobi this week, bringing together policymakers, education experts, campaigners, and representatives from UN agencies, sought ways to address the problem. From the Kenyan capital, Ruben Chama reports.
Teams from Kenya, Ethiopia, Somalia, South Sudan, and Uganda took part in the deliberations. Issues included the impact of conflict and natural disasters on providing education, inequalities among marginalized groups, and sustainable access to quality education. Leonora Makuen is a program specialist at the International Institute for Educational Planning.
It's a global crisis. More than 65 million displaced people throughout the world, of which half of those are children, right? So 1 in 45 children are refugees today. Increasingly, displacement last years, right? So children are missing entire education cycles, and we're missing out generations of learning. So the scale is enormous.
According to the United Nations, developing countries, mostly in Africa, are taking a disproportionate number of refugees, about 80% of the world's refugee population. South Sudan is among the countries in Africa engulfed in civil war. Deng Hok is the country's Minister of Education.
We have still 1.8 million children out of school. We have about 2 million, just over 2 million in our schools, which is a big achievement compared to 300,000 in 2006. We still need to improve the quality of education. Currently, it is variable from one school to another. We need to invest in in-service teacher training. We need to implement the new school inspection system. There are many reforms that need to be implemented to address the issues of access, quality, and equity.
Refugees hosted in developing countries put enormous pressure on education, water, and healthcare systems in host communities. In Kenya, for example, hundreds of thousands of refugees and asylum seekers, mostly from Somalia and South Sudan, have been living in the Dadaab and Kakuma refugee camps.
That was Ruby Chama reporting from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. And that's it for this Thursday, March 22nd edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineers, I'm James Barton in Washington saying have a good day, Africa.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat.
African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat and dumbolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.